Hello, and welcome to the 13th and final episode of Season 3 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Before the Christmas break, Graham, we spent two episodes looking at how banks go about determining financial crime risk ratings for their clients.
We did, and we saw the various attributes that are taken into account to determine whether any given client represents an elevated financial crime risk to the bank, and we saw how the bank would divide its client base into different tiers of risk, which would typically be high, medium and low.
Yes, and they would then use this to apply a risk-based approach, concentrating their resources at the riskier end of the classification.
Absolutely right, Ray. And we introduced right at the end of the last episode the concept of the business-wide risk assessment that banks need to prepare, which will underlie many aspects of their client risk rating. And today we're going to be talking about that.
Great. But I think after we've done that, we might usefully spend a bit of time reflecting on the new UK anti-money laundering regulations that were passed by Parliament just before Christmas. There are just a few points that will have quite wide and immediate application for our UK listeners in particular, so a heads up might not go amiss.
Good call, Ray. Let's have a look at those.
First, though, the business-wide risk assessment. Now, this is a requirement from the money laundering regulations that isn't affected by the new amendments, right?
That's absolutely right, Ray. In fact, it's one of the three high-level risk assessments that are required.
Oh, yeah. There's a national risk assessment to be prepared by government, isn't there?
Yeah, which in the UK is handled by the Treasury and the Home Office together.
And the output from that allows the government to consider the adequacy of current legal and regulatory rules and powers and to allocate a risk-based budget to different threats at a national level.
Absolutely. And then there's the risk assessment by supervisory authorities, which assesses the risks that they have responsibility for in the light of the government's assessment and other relevant international reports and guidelines.
Okay, yeah, as well as the firms they supervise and the risks they present, together with emerging risks and changes in industry that might have an impact.
Spot on.
So then we come to the firm's own risk assessment. And the basic requirement is that the firm, quotes, must take appropriate steps to identify and assess the risks of money laundering and terrorist financing to which its business is subject.
That's really quite a wide and a high-level brief, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Graham.
Is there any more detailed and hopefully helpful requirement?
Well, there is a bit.
Well, go on.
Well, the regulations state that when deciding what steps are necessary, the firm must take into account the size and nature of its business.
Good idea. Does it say how?
No, Graham.
Oh, anything else?
Yes, it says the firm must take into account any relevant information made available by the regulator from its own assessment, and that it must consider risk factors, including those relating to its customers, the countries or geographical areas in which it operates, its products and services, its transactions, and its delivery channels.
That sounds like quite a familiar list, Ray.
Well, indeed. It's similar to the different factors that contribute to the client risk assessment for each individual client. But we're looking through a different lens here. We're looking at these factors as they apply to the whole firm overall.
OK, so if we look at products, for example, when we look at this from a client perspective, what products the client is using will have a bearing on their financial crime risk. But which products carry what sorts of risks is a matter for the firm-wide risk assessment.
Mm.
And that needs to be done first so that we can look at the products used by each of our clients and understand their individual risks.
Mm. So let's look at an example, Graham. At one bank that I'm a customer of, I hold just a savings account. So how would the bank look at my product risk?
Well, Ray, first of all, they'd have to have undertaken a firm-wide risk assessment and assessed the financial crime risk arising from all aspects of their business. Now, in the light of this, they'd have looked at their deposit account offering and determined the specific financial crime risk that could result from its use. And that would be different for different banks, of course.
Why would it, Graham? A deposit account is a deposit account, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, Ray. I mean, for instance, there are instant access deposit accounts that allow third-party payments to be made from them. Effectively, you could write checks.
Well, that would increase the financial crime risks, obviously.
Yes, it would, and the makeup of the bank's account holders would have an impact too. For example, are a significant proportion of them based overseas? Are there minimum or maximum deposits? Are there joint accounts? And if there are, what are the rules around these?
Oh yes, that could be important. If a married couple have a joint deposit account, that's one thing. But if two unrelated people hold one jointly, it could be a way to covertly transfer funds if one makes a large deposit that the other can then withdraw at will.
Exactly. So the firm needs to look at its products, terms, and any vulnerabilities or indeed protections that those create.
Then, armed with the understanding from this assessment, the bank would say that its deposit account had, let's say, a medium level of risk.
Yeah, so that when the bank came to look at the client risk assessment for, say, Ray Blake, they would have a clear understanding of how his using a deposit account contributed to his overall financial crime risk to the bank.
Got it. I can see why the bank needs to undertake its business-wide risk assessment and how this supports the client risk assessments it subsequently makes.
So let's look at how a bank would, based on the quite sparse guidance in the law, go about conducting its business-wide risk assessment.
Yeah, let's. I suppose the first point is that it's going to require input from people across the business, not just the compliance or AFC team.
Oh, absolutely right, Ray.
Now, I've seen AFC departments use workshops and one-to-one engagement with business contributors, often in combination.
Yeah, the one thing that unifies all approaches is that they are based around quite tight and focused agendas. You don't want to waste the business contributors' time, but you also want to make sure you walk away from the meeting with the information you actually need to help you perform the assessment.
So what would that agenda look like, Graham?
Well, Ray, no two will be the same, but let's look at an example or two. I mean, let's say you're meeting business representatives from a specialist department of the bank. So, for instance, the structured finance department.
OK, Graham, let's go with that. I'd want to understand from them who their typical clients are, where those clients are based, what types of client needs the department meets, and what restrictions there are on what they can do and what they can't do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you'd also want to understand their key processes, at least to the extent you can identify financial crime vulnerabilities. You'd want to know about current market trends and those they foresee developing, and any product and process changes they're planning to exploit these trends.
Now, in the AFC team, particularly if you have a compliance remit too, you'll know a lot about this already, Graham, won't you?
Well, you'd hope so, Ray, but the business unit will always know more. They have to be able to do their jobs. And the interviews or workshops are a way of eliciting any important details you're not aware of that are relevant to the financial crime risks.
I can see that. So, actually, the best way might be, as AFC, to document your understanding of this team and its activities, then take this to the workshop and ask, well, what have we missed?
Yeah, and I've seen it done that way, and it can be very effective.
So would you do something similar across all business units?
Yes, all relevant ones, Ray. But you'd also want to look at functions too, like IT or legal or HR.
And why is that, Graham?
Well, because each of those functions could have financial crime risks too. I mean, think about HR, for example. Their recruitment procedures might be vulnerable to a financial criminal gaining employment within the firm.
So the assessment needs to be genuinely firm-wide, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Ray. There's no point in just fixing some of the leaks in your boat.
Good point. Are we interested at this stage in inherent risks or residual risks?
Well, now that's a great question, Ray. But before we answer, do you want to define what those terms mean before we look at them?
OK, sure. Inherent risks are those that exist in an uncontrolled environment. So if we completely ignore any controls that are in place, what are the risks we would see? Whereas if we take into account the controls that we've got in place, these might knock out some or even all of the inherent risks. So what we're left with after the controls are taken into account is the residual risk.
good explanation. And understanding both of these is important. To meet the letter of the law, your assessment needs to understand the inherent risks at a minimum. But understanding your controls and how effective they are is clearly crucial to defending the bank against financial crime threats.
Yes, and the extent and distribution of residual risk needs to reflect your financial crime risk appetite, I guess.
Absolutely right. This is clearly a very detailed assessment, and banks usually try to arrive at quantitative measurement frameworks to make it understandable and usable, but there needs to be a good qualitative understanding across the piece too.
Okay then, so you've produced a business-wide risk assessment. That's going to let you consider what controls you have in place and what additional controls you need to think about. It's also going to help you rate the financial crime risks of different products, channels and so on, which then feeds into your client risk rating approach. It's also going to help you define your financial crime MI and reporting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It will guide the AFC department and senior management of the bank on what they should be keeping a close eye on. And that's going to drive reporting and MI. As you mentioned, it's also going to be a useful check for the firm's financial crime risk appetite.
Brilliant. And this isn't a one-time thing, Graham, is it?
No, Ray. The assessment ought to be refreshed on a regular basis to pick up on all the changes that might alter the picture.
Well, I think that's a pretty good introduction to this important aspect of a firm's defences. There's a lot of excellent guidance on doing this practically in the Wolfsburg Group's 2015 FAQ on risk assessments, and we'll put a link to that on our website for those who are interested. Shall we move on to the updated regulations now, Graham?
Yeah, let's do that. This will mostly concern our UK listeners, although, frankly, similar changes are being effected, or are supposed to be being effected, right across the EU and EEA to comply with the fifth anti-money laundering directive.
Indeed. The UK's version is set out in a statutory instrument that's snappily titled the Money Laundering and Terrorist Financing Brackets Amendment Bracket Regulations 2019.
Well, it does what it says on the tin, Ray.
Well, quite so. I've reviewed the instrument to pick out the key relevant changes.
Oh, well done.
Well, I consider taking it one for the team, Graham. Given that the regulation's coming to force on the 10th of January 2020, for the most part, I thought we should cover it in this episode.
Well, that sounds like a very good idea.
Shall I run through the key points?
Oh, please do.
Well, first of all, some more people and things come into scope of the regulations. So letting agents, art market participants, crypto asset exchange providers and custodian wallet providers now find themselves regulated.
Quite right too. And there's an extension for auditors and tax advisors too, I think, isn't there?
Yes, and what constitutes giving tax advice has widened considerably along the lines of the Criminal Finances Act.
And what's the main impact of this on those people affected, Ray?
Mostly for the new people now in regulation, it's going to be the requirement to undertake customer due diligence. So, for instance, a letting agent for the first time has a legal duty to apply CDD both to the renter and to the person letting the land, provided the term or rent passes a minimum threshold.
Well, that seems reasonable.
There's some new definitions around electronic identity verification too, which is the law catching up with technology. But there's a much bigger change that relates to due diligence.
Oh?
There's a whole new chapter in the regulation now about reporting discrepancies in registers.
Now this is going to be big.
It certainly is. Firms now have a duty when collecting beneficial ownership information to check this against the official register.
Now that's Companies House in the UK, isn't it?
Quite so. And where there is a discrepancy, the firm's duty is to report this discrepancy to the register in the UK, as you say, to Companies House.
To be clear, Ray, this is just information relating to the beneficial ownership of the entity, yep.
Yes, it is, Graham. And there's an exemption as well from reporting where the information is covered by legal privilege.
OK, and what does the register have to do with these reports?
Well, it has to, and I'm quoting, take such action as the registrar considers appropriate to investigate and, if necessary, resolve the discrepancy in a timely manner, unquote.
Now, where does this leave the bank who have to complete this due diligence before transacting for a client? Do they have to wait for the registry to resolve the discrepancy before they can take on the client?
Well, they probably want to take legal guidance on this, Graham, but I'd say not, provided they can satisfy themselves of the veracity of the information they hold.
OK, but usually the way they'd establish that veracity, we wouldn't necessarily agree with this, but would be to check the register agrees with what the client has told them.
Well, true, but they can obtain other evidence, like shareholder declarations in audited accounts, for example. Once they're sure they have the correct version and that the registry records are incorrect, I think they should have confidence in taking the client on while the registry investigates. But they'll want to keep very good records of how they satisfied themselves sufficiently if they do that.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, in a way, Ray, this is really no different from the current status quo, other than there's a legal requirement to do it. But obviously a firm should always be checking their records against Companies House and reacting if there are discrepancies accordingly.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. As you say, though, the legal requirement adds a wrinkle to it.
It certainly does.
OK, elsewhere in the amendments, there's some helpful clarification on the need to conduct EDD where high-risk third countries are involved. The 2017 regulation said you needed to apply EDD quotes in any business relationship or transaction with a person established in a high-risk third country, unquote.
Yeah, I remember.
Well, now there are 2 points of clarification on this. The first one is that transactions will be caught when either of the parties is established in the high-risk third country.
OK, it makes sense. And the second clarification.
Well, this is interesting. The new amendments define what being established in a country actually means. It says that for a business, it's where you're incorporated or have your principal place of business. If you're a regulated firm, it's where your principal regulator is. And for an individual, it's where you're resident, not necessarily where you were born.
OK, now that's important. The banks usually, as we saw, link their country risk score for a client to more factors than that. They look at where a corporate client does business, for example, not just where it's headquartered. And for an individual, they'd look at nationality as well as residence and base their country risk score on the highest risk of those countries.
And to be clear, they can and should continue doing that. But just in the case where this short list of defined very high-risk countries are involved, their requirement to conduct EDD is driven by a smaller set of factors.
OK, but there's nothing to stop firms choosing to do EDD in a wider range of situations.
Oh, no, nothing at all. And for most banks, it won't be worth the operational expense of adding more complexity to this.
Agreed. Good. And there's more on EDD, isn't there?
Yes, there is. The new regulation spells out certain minimum points that EDD must cover, and it's these. A. Obtaining additional information on the customer and on the customer's beneficial owner. B. Obtaining additional information on the intended nature of the business relationship. C. Obtaining information on the source of funds and source of wealth of the customer and of the customer's beneficial owner. D. Obtaining information on the reasons for the transactions. E. Obtaining the approval of senior management for establishing or continuing the business relationship. And finally, F. Conducting enhanced monitoring of the business relationship by increasing the number and timing of controls applied and selecting patterns of transactions that need further examination.
OK, that's pretty comprehensive. Now, most banks are going to be doing most of this already, though, aren't they?
Yes, but now the requirement is so explicit, Graham, I suspect firms will be checking their EDD templates to be sure they have it all covered.
I agree, Ray. Anything else we should know about in the new regulations?
Well, Graham, I've read all 37 glorious pages of it, and I reckon we've covered the main relevant items.
Well, thank you for that. And with that done, I think we should celebrate reaching the end of our third season of podcast, Ray.
Oh, yes. Our first episode came out almost exactly a year ago on the 6th of January, 2019. And this is our 40th episode.
And they said it wouldn't last.
Well, we started it as a bit of a sideline and it's quickly become the most important thing we do. That said, we have an incredibly busy January, so we're going to take a shortish pause before we dive back and kick off season 4.
Yes, we expect to have the first episode of season 4 with you by the end of January, but between now and then, we're going to take a little break.
I'm looking forward to it.
The episode or the break?
Yes, Graham.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.